Welcome to Two-Way Street. Our guest today is author Sebastian Younger. He gained fame with the publication of his international best-selling book, The Perfect Storm, back in 1997. He's been writing blockbuster bestsellers ever since. Younger also co-directed Restrepo, about his months living with a platoon of U.S. soldiers in one of the hottest danger zones in Afghanistan. The picture was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary and won the Grand Jury Prize at the Cannes Film Festival. Younger's new book is Tribe, on homecoming and belonging. In it, he argues that we've lost the connective tissue that once bound human beings together as tribes working for the common good. He relates this to the problem of reintegration into society that so many veterans experience when they return from war. We talked with Younger as part of our occasional series of shows recorded in front of live audiences at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library. You grew up in...
I grew up in Belmont, Massachusetts.
Belmont. So tell us about your community.
Okay, such as it was. This is how my book begins. In the fall of 1986, just out of college, I set out to hitchhike across the northwestern part of the United States. I'd hardly ever been west of the Hudson River, and in my mind, what waited for me out in Dakota and Wyoming and Montana was not only the real America, but the real me as well. I'd grown up in a Boston suburb where people's homes were set behind deep hedges or protected by huge yards, and neighbors hardly knew each other. And they didn't need to. Nothing ever happened in my town that required anything close to a collective effort. Anything bad that happened was taken care of by the police or the fire department. The sheer predictability of life in an American suburb left me hoping, somewhat irresponsibly, for a hurricane or a tornado or something that would require us all to band together to survive, something that would make us feel like a tribe. What I wanted wasn't destruction and mayhem, but the opposite, solidarity. I wanted the chance to prove my worth to my community and my peers. But I lived in a time and a place when nothing dangerous ever really happened. Surely this was new in the human experience, I thought. How do you become an adult in a society that doesn't ask for sacrifice? How do you become a man in a world that doesn't require courage?
Wow. So that's a great starting point. You take us all the way back to colonial America, and you talk about the fact that there was this really interesting phenomenon that you as an anthropologist were fascinated by.
Yeah, I mean, thinkers and writers at the time almost sort of complained about this. One of them, a French emigre named Crèvecoeur, said that there are thousands of examples of white people who ran off to join the Indians along the frontier. And he said, we don't have even one example of an Indian who ran off to join the white people. And I realized later, while thinking about this, that there's this phrase, to go native. And there's no phrase to go civilized, because no one wants to do it. And the book really is important. I mean, it's interesting. Some of the reviews, bizarrely, think that the book is about PTSD and soldiers. I talk about that in the third chapter, 3 out of 4 chapters. But it really isn't the point. I wanted to use soldiers and PTSD as a way of understanding our society, not the other way around.
Yeah. Ben Franklin at one point said that once they were liberated, assuming they'd been captured, they were impossible to keep at home. What were they finding when they went off to live with the Indians?
Yeah, and just to be clear, these were colonists who were kidnapped by the Indians, right, and then later repatriated to their homes. And as he said, they were impossible to keep at home. They would go back to their abductors, back to their adopted families. One of the things that people at the time thought, and again, this is a society that's considered itself Christian and superior. And it did not make sense that people would run off to join what they called the savages, right? It just did not make sense. What people even then understood was that Native society was incredibly egalitarian, and that colonial society was not. I mean, you still had the divine right of kings, and you had extreme class stratification. And in Native society, partly because it was a very mobile society, there's really no way to accumulate wealth. There's certainly no way to pass wealth on through generations. And people were pretty much judged on their own merits. And And that was incredibly appealing. That's innately appealing to human beings, and people kept running off to be part of it. The other thing I think is that there's something, and I know this from having been with soldiers in combat, there's something very, very appealing, and again, ancient and human, to existing in close groups of 30, 40, 50 people that are sleeping together, eating together, hunting, fighting together, existing together, depending on one another. That's our human evolution, and it's recreated in a platoon. It's also what they found in native society.
And this is all part of the same thing that you're talking about, where because we are people who are so highly competitive, so driven by a need for money and status, we've lost the ability to work with one another and to live together in a manner in which we support each other.
Yeah, I mean, the book started as partly as an attempt to understand why American soldiers have such high rates of PTSD. And then I thought, okay, well, that's just one form of mental illness, mental disorder. What about the others? And in fact, as wealth goes up in a society, the suicide rate tends to go up. The depression rate tends to go up, even schizophrenia. It would make sense that modern societies, affluent societies, have high rates of PTSD as well. And what it seems to be, mental illness seems to be quite closely correlated with individualism. So the more of an individualistic life that you lead, the more at risk you are of suicide, depression, enduring trauma reaction, all of those things. The irony, of course, is that affluence brings a lot of good things, but it also brings psychological hardship. Poverty, on the other hand, brings enormous hardship, but a kind of psychological comfort. The communal interaction enforced by poverty. The poorer you are, the more you have to rely on other people. Despite the very real stress of that, it actually helps people's state of mind and it buffers people against mental illness. I found one incredible study. They compared depression rates in North America to depression rates in Nigeria. You know, one of the most messed up, violent, corrupt, crazy countries in Africa. And I've been there, and it's just completely disorienting society, and very violent and poor. The depression rates were highest in urban women, among urban women in North America, and lowest in rural Nigeria. It's incredible. And when you take modern society, affluent Western modern society, one way to improve mental health is to collapse it, to give it a catastrophe. After 9/11 in New York City, the suicide rate went down. Murder rate, violent crime rate went down. Even Vietnam vets with PTSD from Vietnam said that their symptoms improved after 9/11.
Yeah, you talk about the Blitz in London and what impact those nightly bombings had on the people of London.
Yeah, I mean, you all know about the Blitz, right? 30,000 civilians were killed over the course of 6 months by German bombs. You had strangers sleeping shoulder to shoulder on subway platforms. Really living in cramped misery, forming bucket brigades to put the fires out in buildings, you know, digging wounded people and corpses out of the rubble. You know, often, you know, they would find someone who was badly wounded and they would just inject them with morphine and move on and leave them, looking for someone they might be able to save. It was horrific. And the authorities, of course, were sure, they were braced for mass psychiatric casualties. I mean, how could they not be prepared for that? That London was getting bombed harder than most soldiers ever get bombed. And here's civilians, men, women, children, old people, you know, like everybody. And what happened? Admissions to psychiatric wards went down during the bombing and back up when the bombing stopped. And what it seems to be is that if you feel that your community needs you, that your people need you, you don't think about yourself. You know, and again, the irony, and almost you could say the tragedy of affluence, is that we're wealthy enough to think about ourselves. Thinking about oneself does not lead to good psychologically healthy places.
You quote, I think, an unnamed sociologist, in every upheaval we rediscover humanity and regain freedoms. We relearn some old truths about the connection between unhappiness, unselfishness and the simplification of living. And that's certainly what you're saying happened in London during the Blitz.
Yeah.
People came together.
Yeah, I mean, that passage was about the Blitz.
Yeah.
I found another catastrophe that was interesting, the earthquake in Avezzano, Italy, in 1916, I think it was, sometime around then. And something 90% of the population was killed, something like that. It was absolutely horrific, and the survivors took days for help to come, and the survivors sort of banded together, and all distinctions of class disappeared. Rich, poor, didn't matter. Everyone was helping each other. And one of the survivors wrote that the earthquake had produced what the law promises but cannot in fact deliver, which is the equality of all men. Now think about what Franklin and Clef Curl said about the Native Americans, you know, what people were looking for, equality. That's the thing that humans want. And ironically, as societies get more affluent, people don't get more equal, they get less equal. That's the awful thing about it.
We're talking with best-selling author Sebastian Younger about his new book, Tribe, on homecoming and belonging. Our conversation was one of our occasional series of shows recorded in front of a live audience at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library. More with Younger after a break. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. If you're just joining us, my guest is best-selling author Sebastian Younger. He gained fame with the publication of his international best-selling book, The Perfect Storm, in 1997, and has been writing bestsellers ever since. He also co-directed Restrepo, about his months living with a platoon of U.S. soldiers in one of the hottest danger zones in Afghanistan. His new book is Tribe, on homecoming and belonging. So you got your draft card as the war had ended, and you decided you were not going to sign it. You were going to protest the American government and its militaristic policies, I assume, right? Something like that.
Well, something like that. It was my selective service card, and a lot of 18-year-old girls don't know this, but 18-year-old boys, I think a lot of mothers know this. 18-year-old boys get a card in the mail from our government that says, asks them to mail in their address so that you can be found by your government in case of war, in case they need to draft you and put a gun in your hand and send you off to fight somebody. And so I grew up during Vietnam. Every adult I knew was not only against the war but quite outraged by it. I knew that they'd ended the draft, and then I got this card in the mail, and I was just like, what the hell's this? And my father grew up in Europe, in France, and he came to the United States during World War II. He tried to join the U.S. military. He couldn't because he had asthma. He contributed in other ways. He eventually became a physicist. And so when I asked him about the card, he said, no, you're signing that. He said, you don't owe your country nothing. You might owe it your life, depending on the war. Hopefully not. If it's an immoral war, and then it's your moral duty to not fight it, to protest it. But it may be a war that needs to be fought, like World War II did, in which case it's your duty to fight it. And you don't know yet. So you're gonna sign that card and wait and see what happens. And when he put it like that, all of a sudden I had this surge of pride. It wasn't a sort of moral defeat to sign this thing. It wasn't a kind of acquiescence. It was actually my opportunity to be part of something bigger than myself. And it made me incredibly proud to sign it. And I absolutely, had the war been immoral, I was never asked to fight a war, but had it been, in my opinion, immoral, I absolutely would not have fought it. But that never happened.
You were always, like a lot of us, I think, you wanted to be part of something that mattered, right? You really did. And would Sarajevo be the beginning of that?
Yeah.
When you went off, you were 31. We went to Sarajevo to the war?
The first time I actually felt like I had real responsibility, I was doing, I got a job doing tree, I was a climber for tree companies. Yeah. And I was working 70, 80 feet in the air, on a rope with a chainsaw, taking big trees down over houses, and you know, and I understood up there that a mistake could put a huge tree limb or the top of a tree through someone's roof, or a mistake could kill me. And it was the first time that I really understood, like, wow, this is reality. Like, if, I mean, this like, there's no rewind, there's no hitting rewind. This is the real thing. This is the real deal. And it was what I was looking, you know, frankly, having grown up in a sort of affluent suburb where consequences seemed actually not only easy to avoid, actually quite hard to find. So I kept putting myself in places where there were consequences. And Sarajevo, the Bosnian Civil War was the first time I was in a war, and then you really understood consequences.
Okay, before we get, as long as you talked about your job climbing trees, I want to ask you, everybody in this room got to know you probably first reading your remarkable book, The Perfect Storm. Is the story true that you had an accident working as an arborist with a chainsaw? Tell that story. Is that correct?
Yeah,
that led you to writing the book?
It's not much of a story, but I realized tree work scared me, you know? And I mean, I knew I could die doing that job or get badly hurt. But then it occurred to me after I hurt myself, I realized nothing was going to happen to me in a tree randomly, that if I got killed, it's because I made a mistake, that my fate was completely in my hands. We were just dealing with the laws of physics. You know, you cut the top of a tree off over your head, you cut it wrong, it comes back on you and crushes you. You did that. Like, no one ran at red light and hit you, T-boned your car. You know, you did that, right? So what I did was hit the back of my left leg with the chainsaw and open it up across the, it didn't cut the Achilles, but I could see the Achilles. And in case you're wondering, it's white and about the thickness of a number two pencil. But
let's get that image in our head.
But you know, it got me thinking about dangerous jobs and how people die all the time in this country doing really dangerous jobs that the nation needs done, drilling oil and cutting trees, you know, logging and commercial fishing. And that eventually led to writing The Perfect Storm.
Hey, you went off to report on the sword fishermen in Massachusetts, right?
Yeah.
Heard the story about, okay.
I mean, I was living in Gloucester, actually, when I hurt myself. And I was still limping around Gloucester when this big storm hit. And I thought, okay, maybe I'll write about this storm. I wasn't a professional writer yet, right? I mean, I wanted to be. And once in a while, I got something published in a magazine, but that was about it.
So you had your first taste of war in Sarajevo and your first opportunity to see how war affected communities of people. What'd you learn?
Well, it was sort of extraordinary. I mean, this was a civilian population, modern city that had been surrounded by a modern army that used them for target practice for 3 years, and they killed or wounded a fifth of the population. There was no power, there was no running water. You know, people cooked their meals on twig fires, and you'd see people, you know, men dressed like me in suits, you know, coming back from work dragging a firewood down the street and or a jug of water. And the way they got through was that they reverted to a kind of communal life. They lived together in the basements of buildings. The young men formed militias to defend their neighborhoods. They learned how to shoot, they learned how to fight. I met a woman named Nizara who at 17, basically all the teenagers lived in the basement of this building. The parents still lived in the apartments, but the children were safe and they all lived in the basement, and the boys would go off to fight for 10 days at a time, and they'd come back to this sort of society, this sort of youth society in the basement. The young women would welcome them back, they'd have a big party, and they got through the war that way. And she, I mean, I'm just going to tell her story because it's so extraordinary. She was hit by a fragment from a tank round that hit her parents' apartment at 17 years old, almost took off one of her legs. Her father rushed her to the hospital through the shelling, the doctor was going to just amputate her leg. I mean, this was straight American Civil War medicine, right? They didn't have time or medicine to deal with anything. But the doctor knew the family and said, okay, I'll try to save her leg. And he did, but he had to operate on her without anesthesia. And so when I met her 20-some years later, last summer, I had the chance to go back to that beautiful city. But she said to me, you know, the war was terrible, but the truth is we all miss it. And she said, we were better people. We were more generous. We stuck together. We had more fun. We laughed more. Now we're okay, but we're leading our individual lives and we're miserable.
You know, there's an echo of that in a quote you have from somebody who survived the Blitz, who says, I wouldn't mind one night a week of the Blitz again. It really gave us something important.
This is a guy who lived in London. He said, bombing once a week. It was pretty exciting. I wouldn't mind that.
Yeah. All right. So given all that background, let's move forward to Afghanistan, if we can.
I went there in 1996. I went there because it was the wildest, most ancient-looking country I'd ever seen in photos. And there was a civil war going on there that really sort of interested me in the wake of the Soviet withdrawal. And so I was in Kabul right when the Taliban were just about to take it. I got shot at by a Taliban machine gunner in August of 96 on the outskirts of Kabul. I went back in 2000 with Ahmad Shah Massoud. I just kept going back. It was
He was the head of the Northern Alliance, right?
Yeah, that's right. My first real experience with PTSD was after my trip in the fall of 2000 to Badakhshan in northern Afghanistan, where we got caught. I mean, back then the Taliban had MiG jets, they had tanks, they had everything, and we got caught in a Katyusha rocket barrage in a frontline position, and very intense. Our pack horses were killed. But came home. I came home really altered by that and other stuff. And I got back to New York, and one day I went down to the subway, and I just had this massive panic attack. Everything was too bright, too loud, too moving too fast, too many people. I was absolutely terrified, and I ran out of there, and I didn't seek help. This is going to sound strange. I didn't seek help because I just thought I was going crazy, and I was sort of embarrassed that I was going crazy, and the last thing I was going to do was call a shrink, and have someone sort of witness this. I hoped I'd go crazy, quietly go crazy, and maybe no one would know.
So we move forward. You do eventually go back to Afghanistan, which is where you connect with the 2nd Battalion.
2nd Platoon. 2nd Platoon Battle Company, 173rd Air Force.
Right. Thank you. In the Korngol Valley, which was not only the subject of the book, your book War, but the remarkable documentary that you made, Restrepo. What you learned being embedded with these men who were in what many people, Time Magazine, called the most dangerous spot on Earth, perhaps, in Afghanistan, certainly, right?
Yeah, I mean, when I was there, it would shift around, but when I was there, it was the most kinetic, as the military says, the most combat of any area in Afghanistan. That shifted to other areas later, but while I was there for a couple months, it was pretty intense.
So you show us in the film how the intensity of war bonds these men who you were with. I mean, you were part of this group. Yeah. And one of the things that I remember being so struck by in Restrepo is, what's the mission, the terrible mission that they go off on? I forget the name of it.
Oh, Operation Rock Avalanche.
Rock Avalanche. We live that mission as they're coming under enemy fire, and we see them up close, their fears, their courage. And that's remarkable. But then what's really remarkable is you then show us them, they come back from the mission, and somebody has music playing. And they're all dancing like they were kids at a party. And they're dancing with each other, and the joy is remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, they're young men, and they're full of joy. And they're also full of combat. I mean, they're full of everything. It was just this sort of wonderful sort of male energy. And the thing is, if you saw your high school kid doing that in high school, you wouldn't think anything of it. those guys, the reality of combat, it actually doesn't diminish our other human qualities. It actually amplifies them.
Interesting. You say something really interesting. If war were purely, absolutely bad in every single aspect and toxic in all its effects, it would probably not happen as often as it does.
There are positive reactions to it. The reactions to it are not all negative. Likewise, 9/11 in New York, there were positive reactions to a tragedy. No one's arguing that war isn't a tragedy. But what's really interesting is to watch the human animal react in a positive way to something bad. I would say, I think any evolutionary biologist would say that absolutely makes sense in the context of human evolution. If we reacted badly to bad things, we wouldn't exist. Tragedy brings us together, reinforces core human values. War contains these incredible examples of these core human values of loyalty to the group and bravery, the reality of cowardice as well, inclusion, love. These are the things that made humans human and allowed human society to survive in a very harsh environment for hundreds of thousands of years.
Did the Congo Valley, was it one of the things that gave you a higher sense of purpose and helped you feel, I am now living a larger life, the kind of life I've wanted?
For me, journalism makes me feel like I'm some utility to society, that I'm living a somewhat larger life. What's intoxicating about journalism to me isn't the bullet dodging aspect of it in a war.
You kind of like that, though. You said that you really get off on the excitement of being in battle, right?
Well, I have to put a finer point on it.
Okay, thank you.
Fear feels horrible. It really feels horrible. The drama of combat is very compelling. But with the times that I've been in extreme danger, I had bullets landing around me. You are blank with fear, and it does not feel good. But what really is compelling about that job is the sense of purpose and meaning, and the fact that you are providing vital information to the world community about a tragedy. That is what really is addictive about it.
In Restrepo, you do have one of the men. You have him talking about battle, and he says it's like crack. Once you've been in combat, there's no thrill quite like it.
Yeah, I mean, all of your human capacities, all of your senses, your capabilities are just amped through the roof. I mean, a massive amount of adrenaline. Your senses are incredible. I mean, you are really experiencing your full biological reality in combat. I mean, when we're functioning at that incredibly high level, I mean, humans love that, and combat brings that out, and it does get that component for soldiers. Journalism is much more passive. Soldiers are active in combat. The problem with being a journalist is you're being acted upon, and so there isn't that equivalent, like, heightening of performance, because you're really not you're not doing anything active in that sense.
We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll have more of our conversation with Sebastian Younger. You're listening to Two Way Street. Let's get back to our conversation with author Sebastian Younger, the author of The Perfect Storm and other best-selling books. Younger was also the co-director of the documentary Restrepo, about the men serving in one of the most dangerous hotspots in Afghanistan. His partner on the project was war correspondent Tim Hetherington, who was later killed covering a battle in Libya. So let's drive toward PTSD. I think one of the saddest statements in your book, you don't mind.
No, please.
You say, today's veterans come home to find that although they're willing to die for their country, they're not sure how to live for it. That's really chilling. Tell us what that means.
Yeah, I mean, I go on, if I'm remembering that paragraph correctly,
We can find it.
We can find it, yeah. I, Yeah, I mean, it might actually
wanna,
might be,
you wanna go,
it might
go
be
to
good.
It?
You can read it or I can read it.
I'd read your, it's your book. Here you go.
All right, you ready for this one? It's a good paragraph, actually. Today, sometimes I disappoint myself when I read stuff.
And why?
Sometimes, I don't know. Sometimes I think, oh, it's not as good as it could be. But this actually is a paragraph I'm quite proud of. Today's veterans often come home to find that although they're willing to die for their country, they're not sure how to live for it. It's hard to know how to live for a country that regularly tears itself apart along every possible ethnic and demographic boundary. The income gap between rich and poor continues to widen. Many people live in racially segregated communities. The elderly are mostly sequestered from public life, and rampage shootings happen so regularly that they only remain in the news cycle for a day or two. To make matters worse, politicians occasionally accuse rivals of deliberately trying to harm their own country, a charge so destructive to group unity that most past societies would probably have just punished it as a form of treason. It's complete madness, and the veterans know this. In combat, soldiers all but ignore differences of race, religion, and politics within their platoon. It's no wonder that many of them get depressed when they come home.
Wow. What you basically are telling us is we put the blame for soldiers who come back struggling to adjust on the experiences they've had overseas in war and combat. That's not where you think perhaps their real problem lies. It's here, yes?
Yeah, I mean, the recovery from trauma is affected by the level of social support and cohesion that you get afterwards. I mean, if you traumatize a rat and put it in a cage by itself, it does not recover. If you put it back in a cage with other rats, within a week, it's pretty okay. But to me, what's even more interesting is that the rate of PTSD in the U.S. military and the application for disability benefits is far, far higher than the percentage of people who experience combat. In other words, around 10% of the military experiences combat. Something like 20% of the military has been diagnosed with PTSD, and the disability application rate in the U.S. military for PTSD and a couple of other issues is almost 50%. As casualties decline in wars, war after war, the disability rate climbs. They should be going in the same direction. They're going in opposite directions. What I say in my book is that you don't have to be traumatized to experience a real psychological distress when you go from the cohesive communal nature of a platoon back into the individualistic nature of this society. And if you look at Peace Corps volunteers who were not traumatized, but they spent a couple of years in, say, a village in Cameroon, very close, cohesive society, and when they come back, they have quite an elevated rate of depression here. It's not a big party when they come back. They're extremely lonely. Children coming back from summer camp often really get depressed because suddenly they're not sleeping in a big room with a bunch of peers. This will be my last example of this, but it's tremendously poignant for me. During my book tour, just a few days ago, I was talking with a young woman who read my book. And she said, you know, I'm not a soldier or anything, but she said, I had cancer. And when I was diagnosed, all my family, my people, my community, my tribe just rallied around me. And she said, I beat the odds. They stayed with me. And I beat the odds, and I survived. And now I miss being sick. You know, so if you have a woman like Nidzara missing the war, when you have a young woman who survived cancer missing being sick, something's really missing. There was graffiti in Bosnia that said things were better when they were bad. And I think a lot of people intuitively sort of like feel that way.
And just to bring it 360 for a moment, this is what takes us all the way back to the opening of your book. You as a young kid in Boston suburb looking for some meaning, looking for a community that came together. White settlers who felt more comfortable in an Indian tribe because the community brought them together and they shared values. So you say about the veterans returning, the way in which we fail them, among other things, is that you quote a couple of anthropologists who say there are like three critical factors to soldiers' successful reintegration. And people can read the book. We don't have to go into a great detail about it at this point. But the point is, you believe that it is our failure as a society in the way we treat each other and what we do for these returning veterans. You say, thank you for your service is not the answer to helping soldiers feel reacclimated.
Yeah, I mean, cohesion helps everyone recover from life's difficulties. We're a society with very low cohesion. Utility helps, having a job. It's very hard. A lot of soldiers came back to a pretty crippled economy and really could not get work. You want to feel necessary. You were very necessary in your platoon. You fought for this country. Suddenly, you're not necessary to this country anymore. And then finally, there's this sort of double-edged sword of disability payments. They're in some ways a gesture of gratitude by the nation to the veteran, whether it's for PTSD or whatever it may be. But on the other hand, they allow veterans to not have to work often. And when you do that, you are removing yourself from society. We have people, you know, we all have to work. Work's part of life, you know. And if you're removed from that part of life that everyone else experiences, you will have a very, very hard time feeling like you're part of society. And one of the most devastating things that can happen is to a person is to be granted sort of victim status.
Yeah.
Victim status feels like a benevolent act. I feel sorry. I have compassion for you. I'm so sorry for what happened to you. It actually keeps people locked in to a very powerless position, often with their own consent. It's a very, very tricky thing. But then in this moment in our country, the politics of sort of withdrawing some of that financial support are, you know, just too dangerous for anyone to tackle. So it stays in place.
So my mother used to say all the time, she's a World War II bride, okay? And she used to tell us when we were growing up during Vietnam, my mom would say to me, you know, during World War II, we had a mission. We were part of that war. We had rationing, we had gas stamps, everything. The problem with Vietnam is that nobody feels like they're part of it. And you point that out too. And you use the Israeli army as an example of that.
Yeah, and keep in mind, PTSD rates are extremely hard to measure. They're kind of squishy, but the most solid figure that I could get from the Israeli military was 1% PTSD compared to 20% in this country.
Because the soldiers are part of the community. It's a shared fight, right? I
mean, civilians all served in the military, it's basically a tribal society with the war at its doorstep. Keep in mind, this is not in my book, but it came to light later, that this problem returning, it helps if you return to a nation that feels like a cohesive nation that's all striving towards a common good, which I think that feeling is being eroded a little bit recently in this country to the detriment of everyone's, frankly, to the detriment of everyone's psychological health. But returning back from combat, from a life in a platoon in combat to modern society, still has never been easy. And it wasn't easy back in, you know, during the Siege of Troy. I mean, you know, the Iliad's a tough book. The Odyssey is a real nightmare. You know, I mean, that's the really tough book for those guys. And more recently, way more recently, there's an amazing movie about World War II, soldiers returning from World War II called The Best Years of Our Lives. Incredible film, right? When I first watched it, at first I thought that the name referred to, was sort of ironic and bitter, like they took the best years of our lives from us. And then you realize, as you watch the film, you realize, like, no, they're being completely literal, like those were the best years of our lives.
That's a great realization. Most of us have, I hope, seen that picture, and if not, you should. I never realized that.
Yeah,
that's really
that
good.
Occurred to me because I know so many soldiers who wish they were back in combat. Yeah. It was like, that was it. That was us at our peak. Let me just describe a scene at the end of the movie. They're in a taxi, right? They're dropping each other off at their homes, right? The families don't know they're coming back. They haven't seen their families in years, right? They don't know they're coming back. There's like three or four guys in a taxi. They can't deal with it. They stop at a bar. They have a few drinks. They get back into the taxi, and they're making these stops, one house after another, dropping each other off. And they pull up to one house. And the guy, he's like, listen, can we just maybe just have one more drink? Yeah, and right. the everyone else is like, no, you got to go see your family. Like, they don't even know you're here yet. Like, go, you got to do it. So he looks at the house with the steps leading up to the porch and his whole domestic life inside there. And he takes a breath and he says, I feel like I'm about to hit a beach.
Wow.
Imagine.
So what was the reintegration like for you personally? Did you experience? You talk way back in 2000 about what you experienced in the New York subway. Well, you were in a much more dangerous situation in Korngold, right?
I mean, after 2000, I was deeply traumatized by some very tough things that had happened that I saw. In the Korngold, what was tough wasn't that I'd been traumatized. Being in danger isn't that big a deal. You get over it pretty quickly. And again, if we didn't get over it pretty easily, we wouldn't exist. We wouldn't survive. We wouldn't have survived. What is very hard to get over is the loss of human connection. I experienced a human connection that was more profound than anything with that platoon because of those circumstances. It was more profound than anything I'd ever experienced in my life. And what was traumatic about it was leaving it. I mean, that was the real trauma, was coming home, because I had to give that up. And I was bereft. And I really, really hurt me. I mean, I was really depressed. And my marriage ended in part because of my reactions to the combat and to that loss when I came home. And you talk to soldiers and vets, like every 10th soldier, if you say, who here is divorced because, because of the consequences of the war, emotional consequences of the war, and, probably 10% of them raise their hand.
You come home and you and your wife are like strangers. Is that a fair way to put it?
Not immediately, but it really, really got bad after Tim was killed. I mean, that really pushed me over the edge.
Tim was killed in Libya, right, in 2011, yeah. April 2011, something
yeah,
like that?
Yeah, on an assignment that we were supposed to be on together. At the last minute, I couldn't go. He went on his own. He got killed. And, I experienced it. Very dangerous and profound depression, where I literally felt like I was a ghost in my own life. I mean, I just didn't. I had absolutely no emotional connection to anybody or anything, and I was really in danger.
You have a question?
My son went to Iraq, came back after two tours. He had the RPG hit the tank, so he had traumatic brain injury and PTSD. So we have a big failure because we have a poor VA. What do you feel with moral injury when these guys come back that have been a machine gunner and had to kill women, children, whatever? How do you feel that impacts?
Thank you for that. I think what's now called moral injury is one of the most devastating things. I mean, with PTSD, the most harm, psychological harm, comes from seeing harm to others. Being in danger yourself you can recover from that pretty quickly. Seeing harm to others, and I know this from personal experience, completely messes you up, which is an interesting thing about our species. Says good things about our species. I think what's damaging is that soldiers, and this is our fault, soldiers feel that the things that they committed, the things that they did, the acts that they committed on the battlefield, that they sort of own them, right? Because they come back, and civilians really are loath to acknowledge that when a civilian was killed on the battlefield, that we killed that person too. Like, we paid for the bullet, we bought the gun, we built the plane, we built the boat, we voted for the people that started the war. I'm not even anti-war. I think there are some wars that need to be fought. I'm not saying any of this is an anti-war statement, but I'm just saying that when the Apache went to war, like 30% of the tribe were young men and they had bows and arrows in their hands, but the whole tribe was at war, right? And when a modern nation goes to war, they imagine that only the soldiers are actually going to war. And I think if soldiers understood that we collectively are owning all the good and all the bad that happened in the war, it's ours. It is morally, politically, economically ours. I think that would be enormously helpful to the young man or young woman who inadvertently killed a civilian and is trying to live with the guilt of that for the rest of their life.
Thank you for your question. So let's do this and close with this. Again, you talk a lot about what we owe veterans and how we ought to think about reintegrating them, this whole notion that we own the war as well as them. All that's really powerful and important. But your book also tells us something about how we ought to start thinking about how we live our lives together in our communities. And that brings us to the political. How do you unify, you say, a secure, wealthy country that is sunk into a zero-sum political game with itself? How do you make veterans feel that they are returning to a cohesive society that was worth fighting for in the first place? So yes, on one hand, that's about veterans, but it's about us. What do you see in terms of this uncohesive society we're living in right now as you watch the presidential race unfold?
Well, in World War II, African Americans and white Americans fought side by side in the battlefields of Europe and the Pacific. And when they came home, they couldn't eat at the same lunch counter in the country they fought for. And some of those men lived long enough to see an African American president. Right? Things can change. We still have a long way to go. And what I've seen, I'm 54, what I've seen in the last maybe 10 years is a new manner of speaking, a new manner of talking about your political rivals. And it's a use of contempt and derision and mockery that I've never heard before. And I'm not like pointing my finger at you-know-who. I'm really not. Both political parties have done it. I'm a Democrat. I have no problem saying it in public. I'm a Democrat. I'm liberal. I had a lot of liberal friends who literally accused George Bush, who I was not a fan of George Bush, but he was my president. And I had liberal friends who literally were trying to tell me that he was a fascist. Now, you better read about fascism in Spain and in Germany before you say something that stupid, you know? And there are conservatives who say the same stupid stuff about our current president. And the point I make in the book is that the one thing you don't do, you can disagree all day long with somebody. You can argue with them, debate with them, dislike them, hate them, I don't care. The one thing you do not do in a communal society where everyone needs each other is mock and use contempt and derision against someone inside the wire. Like, if you're in a platoon in combat, and trust me, there was plenty of conflicts, plenty of guys in that platoon that did not like each other, but there was never the contempt. And when you use contempt for a segment of the population, fellow citizens, the president, the government, whatever, when you use contempt, what you're basically saying is those people, they're in our camp, but they're actually the enemy. They actually shouldn't be in our camp. And when you do that, you create a literally, I don't mean this metaphorically, hyperbole, you literally create a threat to our democracy far, far greater than ISIS, Al-Qaeda ever will be. ISIS and Al-Qaeda, they can hurt us, but they actually can't undermine our democracy. Only we can do that. And it starts with language. So I think in terms of unifying the country, I mean, look, we're a modern country. We're not going to go back to living in lean-tos. I get it. But at the very least, we can act as if we're a unity with a shared goal, a shared identity, a shared purpose in this nation. And if we do that, the effect will trickle down even into our communities, into our neighborhoods. I think one of the reasons many people feel so unconnected to society is because they look up at people in power and they realize that those people don't think we're united either. And so why should we bother?
Sebastian Younger, it's no surprise why you're getting extraordinary reviews for this book.
Thank you.
Because it really is a thoughtful and unique way of telling us how we really need to learn to live with each other in a more communal society, as well as to figure out how we deal with those men and women who go off and fight the wars that we own. Thank you for being here for Two-Way Street, and thank you all for being part of Two-Way Street as well.
Thank you, everybody.
Sebastian Younger and I held our conversation in front of a live audience at the Carter Presidential Library as part of our occasional series of shows that we produce there. You can learn more about his book, Tribe, on Homecoming and Belonging by going to the Two-Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS or on our Facebook page. And if you check us out on Facebook, please like us while you're there. If you think your friends would like to hear today's show, let them know they can listen by subscribing to the Two-Way Street podcast on iTunes and other podcast providers. It's also posted to our website. And those are the places you can listen to Two-Way Street if you can't be near a radio when we're on the air. That's it for this week's show. Our producer is the awesome audio artist Jenny Ament. Our interns are Hannah Rose Adams and Caroline Hayes. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for being with us. I hope to see you back here next week for another edition of Two-Way Street.